The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
I'm going to begin by reading our koan again, but this time a different translation, because it may be that different words will resonate differently for you. This is from the Thomas Cleary translation. Dao Wu tends the sick. Guishan asked Dao Wu, "Where are you coming from?" Dao Wu said, "I've come from tending the sick." Guishan said, "How many people were sick?" Dao Wu said, "There were the sick and the not sick." Guishan said, "Isn't the one not sick you?" Dao Wu said, "Being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him at all. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Guishan said, "Even if I could say anything, it would have no relation." And I'll read the verse. "When has the wonderful medicine ever passed his mouth? Even the miraculous physician can't hold his wrist. As though existent, he is basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he is basically not existent. Not perishing, yet born. Alive, without dying. Completely transcending before prehistoric Buddhas. Walking alone after the empty eon. Subsisting peacefully, sky covers, earth supports. Moving on, the sun flies, the moon runs." I went to medical school, and I can assure you that this koan was nowhere in my curriculum. They did not teach about sick and not sick in this way that completely turns all of our ideas about the world and ourselves on their heads. And yet the Buddha presented the Four Noble Truths like a medical visit. There was the diagnosis. Suffering, that this life is suffering. There was the cause, this ignorance that's ingrained in us, that's why we suffer. As Mike quoted the wonderful dialogue between Vimalakirti and Manjushri yesterday, Vimalakirti said, "My sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence. Sickness arises from the passions that result from the unreal mental constructions. Nothing is perceived that can be said to be sick." And of course, then there is the cure. Vimalakirti says, what is the elimination of this sickness? It is the elimination of egoism and possessiveness. It is the freedom from dualism. So our sickness is this mind of division, this collective mind that is in each of us, the mind that creates divisions that at the grandest scale are divisions of racism and sexism, of divisions of me versus you, and inside our tiny little skulls, the division of me against me. Jordan talked about being at war with himself. Here is this being, Bob, let's say, an imaginary being with no fixed self who not only is imaginary, but sets up another imaginary being to scold, to be critical of. So this endless division, this endless duality that is how our minds encounter the world. When we don't encounter the world that way, then we live in a different way. So traditionally, our traditional idea of health is a firm self that asserts itself and knows who it is. The Bob who's been that way all these years. But our path tells us that this supposed health is itself the mind's disease. It is the sickness of our life. And the traditional sickness is not sickness at all. Physical sickness and dying, as David told us yesterday, is in store for all of us. I was surprised, but if we think about it, that truth, which we keep turning away from, is not sickness at all. It is not the enemy. It is what our body will do. And when it becomes our time to die, that may be just fine. The Buddha got old. He got sick. He died. And as far as we know, he didn't think it should be otherwise. Suzuki Roshi, when he was dying of cancer, said, "I am cancer." And his last words were reportedly, "It hurts." Totally present, totally one with what is. That, in our way, is not sick. When you can be present for whatever comes, and then you can enjoy those preferences that we don't have to let go of. It's only when we are frightened of not getting what we prefer that we suffer, and the world suffers. So the cure for this sickness of dualism, well, we're told it's practicing that eightfold path of right understanding, right thought, right speech, etc. And we're told that by transforming our way of life, living in this way, we'll purify the heart, we'll calm the mind, we'll see the truth. Sounds so easy, yet so hard to do. Because this mind of dualism is not our fault. It is our human condition. And the paradox is that we cure this human condition. We overcome this condition by not overcoming it, by seeing it, by fully embracing it, by becoming intimate with it. The world is burning, and the world is made of love and healing. All of it. And what I have come to know is that my sickness, what I think is most sick about me, is the source of my greatest capacity to be a force for healing. I thought, when I started out, actually, on my medical path, if I don't have it all together, how in the world can I be of help to anyone else? And what I've come to know is that it's in exactly those places, those hurting places, those vulnerable places, when I investigate them, that compassion arises, that feeling with every other human being who suffers, who feels vulnerable. That feeling with is my source of compassion and my greatest source of healing. And that, of course, is all of our jobs as bodhisattvas, to investigate just those places where we feel we are sick, where we feel we are most wounded by the world, where we feel that we are the hardest on other people and hardest on the world. That's where the investigation allows for the arising of this boundless compassion that sets us on the road that Michael was talking about last night, the road to healing. Now, one of the things we know is that traditional medicine as we know it, those are just tiny nudges that our bodies have tremendous power to heal. And without that power, medicine would be ineffective. That we have the power to nudge the universe toward healing. And only by investigating exactly the places where we feel we are sick do we develop the strength and the compassion to align with the healing forces of the universe. The whole world is made of love. The whole world is sick, and the whole world heals. And all we need to do is align with it. And now Melissa Roshi will complete the talk.
So once again, I invite you to stay in your Zazen posture. Even though it appeared that the talk was over, there's a part two. And we encourage everyone to stay upright and still in the middle of hearing the talk, receiving these words, making it a form of meditation practice. I did not go to medical school. However, I have encountered suffering many, many times in my life personally and in the lives of others. And these same issues that Bob Sensei was bringing up are very relevant for me. How is it that we divide the world, sometimes dualistically, sometimes in fractured elements? It's not just this versus that, but it's this and that and this and that and this and that. The chaos that one of you described in our earlier dialogue. How do we meet the world as it is? I was talking to a student the other day, and he's quite a philosopher, this student. He's studied a lot of philosophy. And he was saying that he'd been thinking very deeply about life and death. And he said, I get it that we're all going to die. Intellectually, I know I'm going to die. And then he said to me, but it doesn't make any sense. And we had an amazing talk about what that meant. It doesn't make any sense. The incapacity of human beings to really fully imagine what it's like for our life to end. We know that everyone dies, but how do we live with that knowledge in every cell of our body? In this koan 83, Dawu Tends the Sick, that we've been looking into, there's a commentary towards the end by Wansong, who's the guy who collected this. And he quotes another teacher, a poem by a teacher named Fo Yin, who probably lived some time after our buddies here, Guishan and Dawu. And this is what Fo Yin says as a commentary to this koan. Even living a long time, still, there's no leisure to study. For the time being, I'll study not dying. Even living a long time, still there's no leisure to study. For the time being, I'll study not dying. I was very inspired by this when I read it last night before going to bed. I can't really prepare for a shared talk because I don't know what my first companion is going to talk about. And yet, this line resonates all the way through Bob's talk, all the way through the koan. This tendency that we human beings have to divide the world. And the healing that arises when we see that all of the suffering that we encounter and all of the divisions, life and death and you and me and black and white and women and men and this and that and the other thing are all coming from the same root, which is the heart quivering in suffering. And the heart quivering in suffering is also the heart quivering in compassion, as Bob pointed out. The heart resonates with some deep root where suffering and love are not separate, not opposed to each other, where dying and not dying are not separate, where living in the face of injustice and difficulty, in the face of our own inner struggles, our own endless judgments about ourselves or other people, living with that is in fact fully living. We don't have to get rid of anger. We don't have to get rid of fear or sadness or despair. Instead, we have to make room to have the widest possible spaciousness around everything that occurs. When we find ourselves in opposition, either internally or externally, when we say, I won't do that, or I'm going to do this, or I'm such an idiot, or you're such an idiot, or all the different things that happen, if only those people would, if only I could, we get very, very small and narrow. Everything becomes tight and painful. So the idea is not to try to get rid of that tight painfulness, but to see it for what it is. When we divide the world, we become constricted. And what we have to do in our practice is open, open, open. Open the hand of thought. Open to everything coexisting. Everything coming and going, arising and falling away. Our only job is to sit still. Zen practice is so simple. We make it very complicated, of course, but it's really simple. Just sit still. Don't move. Stay with what's here right now. Don't add anything. And of course, we will add things, and we can't stay with the way things are because our busy minds drag us around. But in that spaciousness, in that compassion, in that opening to the way things really are, everything gets included. A bigger container, as we say, A, B, C, as big as the universe, containing everything, so that when we're in the tightest, most hurt and broken place, a flower shows up right in front of us. The taste of tea, the face of another person, the sound of a bird, the feeling of our cushions or our seats supporting us, the feeling that so many of us at this sesshin are so committed to this work of being a sangha together. As Alan so movingly pointed out, we don't ask you not to move because we're some kind of control freak who thinks that there's a should and a should not. We ask you to practice together and recognize in the most spacious way possible that we really are all one body. Like my student who couldn't understand the reality of death, although heard it as a good as a sensible thing. Yep, we're all going to die, but I can't imagine it. We can't imagine how important we are to the Sangha of all beings. We can't imagine that everything we do and think and say is important. It's unbelievable, as that student said about death. And this fellow, Fo Yin, practicing, studying, not dying. What does that mean? What does it mean to study not dying? Well, it's exactly what we're doing right now. We're studying living. We're studying what it's like to be a human being. As our ancestor Ehe Dogen says, to study the way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to be awakened by everything. When we contract and get small and tight, everything that's yearning with its great love and compassion to awaken us doesn't have any room to get in. But when we're fully present as best we can be, feeling our bodies upright, feeling the stillness of this Zazen practice, this just sitting practice, then there's room to be touched by the unexpected. Things will happen, and the heart mind will respond. Guishan asked Dao Wu, where are you coming from? Dao Wu said, I've come from tending the sick. Guishan said, how many people were sick? Dao Wu said, there were the sick and the not sick. Guishan said, isn't the one not sick you? Dao Wu said, being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with me at all. Speak quickly, and Guishan said, even if I could say anything, it would have no relation with that matter. Thank you. And now, please, make yourselves comfortable, get to move as much as you want, although we'd like you to stick around, and we're going to have our Dharma dialogue. We forgot to say this yesterday, but all of our talks are recorded and will eventually show up on the internet. So if you ever want us to pause the recording, just let us know. And we're going to ask you to raise your Zoom hand. We'll call on you, and Bob and I will respond. So anything about the talk, about your own practice, about what's happening for you. And we'll start with Jordan.
I'm going to offer a bit of intensity. I apologize.
What?
The other day, I was reminded of a bad encounter I had with a police officer. And it's been kind of sitting with me. Being a powerful feeling, it did what it did, and it took me through this kind of mental journey about things that I want to do the way I want things to be. And I realized that the emotion that was taking me through this was one that I hadn't had a lot of experience with. It was more than anger. It was a hatred. It was a very real hate of this person. And I was struck by this interplay between the quivering heart of compassion and the quivering heart of suffering. And I am just wondering how this hate can become this thing that wants to render me separate at every cost from this person, how it can bring me together with not just this officer, but with everything in my life. That was it.
Wonderful. And can I just say, I know Bob's going to say something, but you never have to apologize for bringing intensity to the discussion. I would make a request. Every time you speak, it's really important and relevant, as is true for all of us. And the more we can really come from our truth, the better for the whole Sangha. So thank you.
Jordan, it's such a powerful incident. And what it made me remember was the Dalai Lama talking about when he was held prisoner by the Chinese. And someone asked him, were you afraid? And he said, yes, I was afraid I would lose my compassion for my captors. And so you are not alone. What do you do with the arising of hatred for injustice, for something, for a way you feel wrong, the way you feel hurt? And you're sitting with it. You are being with it, which is our way.
And there's an amazing alchemy to sitting with it, being with it. This is part of our teaching. And we talk about the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance. When we stop fighting those three poisons in our way, in the Mahayana way, which is also the Dalai Lama's way, the great vehicle teachings, which say that we are surrounded by compassion and that there are Buddhas and Buddha fields everywhere, you know, all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that we chant to all the time. This is actually a real, it's hard to imagine, but a real network of love and compassion and protection and a kind of fierceness. So greed and anger and ignorance have the elements inside of them like seeds that can blossom into something else. And anger and hatred blossom into wisdom. You know, Manjushri, who had that wonderful dialogue with Vimalakirti, Manjushri is the embodiment of wisdom, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and he carries a sword that cuts through delusion. Well, to cut through delusion, and you may have noticed this about the teachers, that sometimes we go, We're going to cut through delusion sooner rather than later. Not with everybody, but sometimes that's what's required. And that sharp edge of that sword of wisdom, the other side of it is hatred and anger. So there's a fierceness to your hatred and anger. Once the duality of it drops away, it becomes purified into clarity. So you have to hang out with it long enough, and it hurts. It's no fun to be angry, no fun to feel full of hatred, but it's required under some circumstances, right? We can't help it. And the same thing with greed, desire, that transforms into love and compassion, and delusion, where our mind, that transforms into equanimity. These things just happen. We don't do it. Again, the practice is simple. Sit still and be with your life as it is. And then see what happens. Notice the tightness. Make the spaciousness. That's all. But the anger and hatred could stick around for quite a while. This is not a strategy for getting rid of it. This is actually turning up the fire to cook it so that it turns into what it's supposed to be. Thank you. Let's see who else. Barry, you had your hand up.
Thank you for these profound and beautiful talks. They moved me to tears, including Jordan's. I want to say the phrase, endless divisions, really stuck with me. I know that I'll use it over and over again because I think that's what goes on daily between human beings. These fabricated divisions. And I wanted to say something about death, which is, I've shared before, I've been a career-long suicide preventionist. I spent a lot of time with people who wanted to die, or came close to dying, or survivors of people who have died by suicide. And I'm comfortable in hanging out with that space generally. But as Melissa Roshi commented, that's all well and good, but when it comes to my own death, I have no real glimpse of it. And I think it always comes down to not me, not yet.
Well, I just want to appreciate that phrase, not me, not yet, because it brings us back to what's now, right? Death is not now for you. And that's all you need to be present for. And you have spent a lot of time working with people who say they want to die. And actually what we know is that the vast majority of people who want to die don't continue to feel that way if they live, if they don't harm themselves. And so what practice keeps bringing back to is what is here right now. And we simply watch it as Melissa Roshi was saying, we watch it grow, change, morph, including the fear of death, including the certainty that I need death, all of it part of the flow of existence. Thank you.
Thank you. Graham.
Yeah, I really don't know how I'm going to say this, but it seems that this koan is, it strikes me as a almost a Socratic setup. The first line is, where are you coming from? And to me, that would be a sort of a dowsing phrase, a guiding phrase that you could always bring out if you want to check yourself out, to say, where am I coming from? And from that point on, he starts talking about healing the sick. And this teacher, as Socrates in my mind, is showing him about his self-importance. you know, the Democrats, the sick, the blacks, the whites, the Republicans, the never Trumpers, it's that word THE that is the fragmenter that kind of brings to light the present activity of breaking things up and separating one thing from another and putting yourself in that role. Is the opposite of being a healer, I guess.
That's a wonderful noticing about the word the. I think that is something we do. Language is one of the biggest divisions, dividers, right? Agents of division.
Mm-hmm. The Buddhists, you know.
Yeah, Buddhists. We don't usually say the Grahams and the Melissas and the Bobs, but
right, thank you.
Something we do inside of us that says that. So Graham, how about just a brief, where does it touch you? Like if you know, these are two Dharma brothers. One isn't the teacher and one isn't the student, but just for you, how is it when you confront these things in your own heart?
Well, I have a background as a social worker, you know, the social workers.
Yes, sometimes.
So I'm one of them. but anyway, it's hard to. I mean, you get into the helping professions on the impulse to help people, and to maybe be a healer, maybe bring the space of meditation to a chaotic process, and hopefully draw down the energy to a point where it's manageable. And that almost never happens, you know. And it's mainly, even though it's a kind of a noble entry point, wanting to help people, wanting to heal, it's also a big, fat ego position.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so from that point of view, over the years, you realize, oh, that's what's going on here. That's why things are, and even when you go to church, like I go to an Episcopal church too, and it's very liberal and they're very Black Lives Matter and they're this and that and everything. There's always a question: where are you coming from? Some of the most helpful people get under my skin, you know.
So I'm just going to stop you there. Thank you for responding in that way and the beginning of that investigation that we all have to do. Thanks so much, Graham. Let's move on to Francesca.
Hi. I know that you've probably given examples before, but it would be helpful to me if you could give an example of creating the bigger container. So if I'm experiencing fear or something like that, I can think, well, other people feel fear and, you know, kind of make it bigger that way. But what do you do when it's something like some political figure or something that is doing everything that you really hate and that you're totally against and you know is harmful? How do you create the bigger container for things like that? Is there a step by step?
Yeah, great question. Bob, do you want to?
Sure. It's a wonderful question. And when I answer it, I hope I'll be answering it for myself too, because I have so much the same experience, Francesca, that, like, for example, while on Sesshin, I will not look at the newspaper. But that feeling of that, I think what I hear you describing is this sense of being consumed, being by fear, by anger, by dread of what's happening, and the wider container for me, often is just what's here at the moment. It is literally the tree out the window. It is my water bottle. It is, and that what I find is that the writer David Foster Wallace wrote a phrase that I love: we are trapped in our skull-sized kingdoms. And when I am aware that I am trapped in my fear, in my anger, I find that the wider container is just what's here, right here in this moment. It doesn't mean that the fear goes away, and certainly we don't push it away, but it becomes part of a much bigger picture. And that could also be all the love in the world and all the good things happening in the world, right? So the bigger container can be right here where you are in your room, and it can be what's in the world that you know about that is bigger than and so much wider than this narrow little thing that's frightening you.
And to go back to what you said about one way, you know, if something's going on that you... if you're feeling something towards somebody, you think about, what did you say, that they're suffering or, you know, right, that you have another thought that helps with the original thought.
Right. Well, like, say, I know somebody, political figure, is doing something harmful in the world, and now I'm thinking, if this continues, what's going to happen in the world, you know, and I hate what's happening, and I don't want that person to keep doing the same thing. And I don't want to be like non-active in that the person actually continues to do it, and then it has disastrous results because people didn't act.
Yeah. So there's an interesting. I just want to redirect you towards a different way of doing a bigger container. Because when we have these painful thoughts and we bring up other thoughts, that's not making a bigger container. That's just taking the little tiny container and throwing more stuff in it. So the bigger container is really to, you know, listen, feel, notice what else is going on. What's going on in my own body when I'm thinking these thoughts? That's a good place to start. So that begins to make a bigger container. But if you try to fight a thought with a thought, you're just making more, there's a Buddhist term, mishigas, that we like to use. That's a Yiddish term.
The other place of practice, I think, is how do I encounter it when I am not getting my way, when what I prefer is not happening? How does it arise for me? And so partly we're coming up against that suffering from preferences that I hold to as important, but nonetheless, what is it like when life does not go my way? And that's a place of practice.
Thank you. Thank you. Pierce?
Well, first of all, thanks to all four teachers for these wonderful teachings, which are opening up this koan for me and making me see some application of it to my own life. And I must admit, I'm still puzzling over Vimala Kirti's statement, the world is sick because I am sick. I am sick because the world is sick. And I understand it to mean that, there's a realization there that it's futile to draw a distinction between me and the world. And that if I do so, it's like I'm shooting myself in the foot. But what I notice in response to this world on fire that we have at the moment is that, or maybe it's always on fire, I don't know, is that what arises in me is this duality, this conflict of feelings, that I know what I think, I know what I would do, and I am not very favorably disposed toward contrary opinions. And my first response to that is, don't go there. Don't allow this unpleasant opposition to arise because nothing good can come out of it. And so I'm grateful to Bob for the suggestion, go and look there where it is most painful or most uncomfortable. Because I heard someone else say, David, I think, awareness is its own action, and that this is what is arising in me, and so this is where I should look. And for that reason, I can say with Michael that I really don't think I'm wasting my time here this weekend. Just sitting.
I 100% agree, 1,000% agree.
I love that, Pierce. Thank you so much.
And you know, what you're saying, Pierce, is so important. Everything you're saying, when we hear something like Vimala Kirti's teaching, it's sort of like this teaching about death. I don't get that. Also look towards the I don't get that place, and sit with that. This is the way that we learn to, this is the way we study not dying, I guess. Yeah, and we have, Austin has raised his hand. And Mike, let's go to Austin first, if that's okay.
I can perhaps understand Jordan's feelings with whatever happened to him in his interaction with a police officer. The way I grew up, we don't trust police. I never expect a cop would kill me, but I was pretty certain he could hurt me and get away with it physically. And I carry that with me even today. The question is, if a police officer encounters someone like me or Jordan or who struggles with what it means to be compassionate, how likely is it that we will plant a seed of compassion in them that will grow and change them? I saw a video of a woman attending a Black Lives Matter wrapped in a Confederate flag shouting, "I will teach my grandchildren to hate you." And I think my self-awareness, the time on the cushion, how will that change that woman's hate? The only hope is to hope that enough people aren't like her so that we can vote and make our narrative of compassion be the dominant one in America. And the situation is horrid in this country. And I find it very hard to understand what I can do to really make the change that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Austin, I want to read again from The Way of Tenderness from our reading in the Sutra Service, because you're speaking exactly to that. It says at one point, the way of tenderness does not equal quiescence. It does not mean that fiery emotions disappear. It does not render acceptable that anyone could hurt or abuse life. And so what this practice does not do is advocate quiescence. But as we know, as the Buddha said famously, hate never quelled hate, only love quells hate. So how do we love, how do we act with love to limit and ideally transform some of the forces that you're talking about? That's our koan.
And just to add to that, we can only do what we can do. We cannot say, I want this to happen and it will happen. Right? That's as Americans, we're can-do people. That's the Americans, to go back to Graham's thing, right? We want to just fix the world. But the first thing we have to do is study the self. Get to know it so well that we don't replicate the kinds of injustices that have been done to us. It goes back to Bob's story about the Dalai Lama, right? And it's so easy to lose that perspective, especially in the face of hatred. So wonderful to bring that up. Thank you. So, Mike Sensei?
I just wanted to jump in if there were room or time. I really appreciate this discussion and the many directions it's gone. And I wanted to share that for me, one of the most important practices is just to remain curious, to remain open, to continue to ask, what is in this moment? What is? And so often what I find is that there is some sort of relative truth presenting itself. And I think it's really important not to use our practice to dismiss those relative truths. To not just dismiss somebody's anger or that there has been injustice. Because, you know, we can say as some sort of rule that we buy into that division is the thing that causes harm, and therefore I'm not going to recognize that there are relative truths anymore, that there are, you know, people who identify as black or white, or that there has been injustice. I just want to, you know, put that aside and get to the healed place. And I think that becomes its own form of wounding. So we have to be careful to acknowledge with compassion relative truths. And I think similarly, so that's just, again, turning toward what is, it presents itself, you know. I don't have to turn a stick into a stick. It's a stick. It's how it's presented, right? This is the relative truth of it. And then there's also something that's offered in our practice that is a healing aspect that we're also talking about, and they are not mutually exclusive. And that's where I think we get into trouble as we imagine, oh, if I go to the healing aspect of the absolute, right, things just as they are, then in some way I won't have to deal with the relative anymore. And that's not true. But in dealing with the relative, we can also find the absolute. And that's the key. And that involves our looking with great curiosity. I'm really struck by Angel Kyodo Williams, too. And in our sutra book, she says healing is situated in love. Healing is situated in love. And she says, maybe we believe the right to healing is only for those who have been hurt and oppressed. And we are upset to consider that the one who hurts and oppresses is in just as much need of healing. Opening our hearts to woundedness helps us understand that everyone around us carries the same sense of woundedness.
So Mike, you're beautifully expressing this balance that we're always living into of form and emptiness, of oneness and individuation, and that we can get lost on either side of that continual flow.